Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
I'm Ruth Jackson, part of the Unbelievable team, and you are listening to a classic replay programme from the archives. The episode you are about to hear was first broadcast on Premier Christian Radio on the 10th of October 2009. For the third classic replay in a row, it features Christian Richard Borkham and skeptic James Crossley. In this episode, the two Bible scholars discuss the question of Jesus' divinity. You can get in touch with the show and listen to more episodes at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
You're unbelievable.
Well, for many years, critics of Christianity have suggested that belief in Jesus' divinity and the worship of him must have been a late development in the Christian faith. It's simply inconsistent, they say, with Jewish monotheism that the church was born into. So did the idea of Jesus' divinity develop late, or was it there from the very beginning? Well, answering the critics today, Richard Borkham returns to the show. His new book, Jesus and the God of Israel, claims that the worship of Jesus as God was both very Jewish and very early. Find out why as he debates today with non-Christian New Testament scholar James Crossley. Yes, they've both returned to the studio. Let's find out what they think about this whole subject of Christology.
Well, it's my great pleasure to welcome to the studio once more today James Crossley and Richard Borkham, looking at a different book of Richard's this week, Jesus and the God of Israel, which is really a collection of essays. And the, if you like, the core of it is an essay that you published some time ago, I think, Richard.
Yes.
But again, did cause something of a stir in the area of biblical criticism, an essay entitled God Crucified. Your study here really led you to believe that Christology, and by that we mean the view of Christ, how he is seen by his followers and that sort of thing, as being somewhat different to the way many others have seen it. I mean, would I be right in saying, gentlemen, that there has been a prevailing view that the worship of Jesus as God was kind of a later development than is often claimed by some, and that it was really very different and at odds with a Jewish understanding of God, and therefore can't have been as inherent in the Jewish community as things like the Book of Acts must have been if that was what they were doing at the time. I mean, is that what people have been thinking about it of late?
Yes, I mean, there was a view, it goes back quite a long time, that worship of Jesus only started when Christianity moved out into a pagan context where it was normal, you know, to worship not only a high god but heroes and lesser gods and so forth. I think a number of scholars, I'm not by any means the only one to take this line, have argued in last decade or two, I suppose, that the worship of Jesus actually must have started very early, must have started within the Jewish, Palestinian Jewish Christian community, the First Jerusalem Church. And so we can't explain it as a sort of paganization of Christianity. We've really got to face up to how did it relate to Jewish monotheism, the Jewish belief that there was only one God, God of Israel. And a lot of my work really has grown out of trying to make that relationship. How did the way early Christians thought of Jesus. How did that attribution of divinity in some sense, whatever sense it was, to Jesus, how did that comport with their remaining Christian monotheists? Because I think what's also very clear is that they don't in the least intend to drop their belief in only one God. They remain Jews in that fundamental sense of Jewish monotheism. And of course, it's a very important question of the whole history of Christianity from then onwards, because one could imagine that early Christianity could have developed into a polytheistic cult quite easily, with God the Father, God the Son, different gods. But of course, what Christianity did, in fact, was to hold tenaciously to monotheism and therefore develop the doctrine of the Trinity, which is a way of saying that God is one, and yet the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit share that one divinity, which was a quite remarkable doctrine to come up with, and with the sophistication that the Fathers argued it, they were pressed into that development because they both remained Jewish monotheists and attributed divinity to Jesus.
Now, it remains to this day an important aspect of many people's Christian belief that Jesus is one with God the Father, as it were, of the same substance, as the one formulation of the Trinity puts it, but a distinct personality, if you like, or a distinct person of that Trinity. I mean, so there might be, again, for a Christian theologian, a good reason for wanting to make an early connection with Jesus, and his worship as God. I mean, as a non-Christian coming at this, James, as a historian of the Bible, do you feel a bit less shackled by those kinds of sort of things, so that you can perhaps take a look at this and say, I'm just ready to see where the evidence leads, and if it doesn't show that there was an early worship of Jesus as God in the early church, then that's fine by me. I sometimes get the impression that some, if you like, more sceptical historians want to show that this worship only sprung up at a much later date, in the way that Richard, was illustrating for illustrative purposes there. Because that shows then that really Christianity as such is just a kind of later refining of certain doctrines from some core stories which may or may not be particularly relevant to those doctrines. I mean, but where do you find yourself when you're looking at this issue?
Well, I mean in theory, if there was a powerful argument the earliest Christians from the year dot whatever believed in the full deification of Jesus and worshipped Jesus as if he, some part of Yahweh, or whatever you want to phrase that, then you could accept that if you're a Christian or non-Christian. It really wouldn't necessarily matter. Whether people's faith positions dictate these results, I think, well, probably on both sides, yes. Are they individually doing this on purpose? Probably not. But you do get, we're influenced by our context, Richard, myself, whoever, and no doubt these things feed into it. But ultimately, as I think we said previously, these things have to be discussed in terms of the evidence, and that's how we'll get the results ultimately.
I mean, I suppose I ask because I have heard people on this show using this particular argument that high Christology was very Jewish and very early, for being evidence for instance, the resurrection, that it was only a cataclysmic event such as the resurrection that could possibly cause this, if you like, quite unique thing to develop within a Jewish community, which is to go in this direction of seeing Jesus as God, and that therefore is another, if you like, pillar in the things surrounding it, what is obviously a supernatural event. Obviously, you wouldn't use that. I mean, would you see that as being sort of out of court? Because
no, yes and no. I mean, I wouldn't phrase it in terms of a supernatural event. What we could all agree on, whether we believe Jesus was very literally raised from the dead or not, we could all agree that the first Christians witnessed something and they thought Jesus in very high terms or whatever. I mean, that would have no doubt been a very important development in deifying Christ, no doubt. I think we could all agree on that. We could all have different positions on what we really think is going on, whether Jesus, was really resurrected. But you know, I mean, it's there in 1 Corinthians 15. It's,
So what you're saying is, you, of course, they believed that Jesus had been resurrected. Yes. Whether or not he had been
is another question.
It's another issue. What do you mean, you don't particularly tie that into the resurrection, Richard, but I'd just be interested from my own point of view to know whether you think that these kinds of arguments, not only of Jesus and the God of Israel, but also what we were talking about, you know, previously with Jesus and the eyewitnesses, whether that in any sense for you ties into some kind of argument towards actually a supernatural event such as the resurrection.
Well, I think the resurrection would certainly have made Christians think that Jesus was a person of unique significance. I don't think the resurrection itself would have led to, or need have led to, belief that Jesus belongs to the identity of God, which is the way I put it. I think much more important for the early Christians was the belief that Jesus, after the resurrection, was exalted to heaven and was seated on God's right hand in the heavens. And there's a quote from the Psalms that the New Testament writers use frequently. Psalm 110 begins, "The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool." The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand. And that is remarkably, it's the most quoted Old Testament text in the whole of the New Testament. And that, I think, shows at least that it's a really formative Old Testament text from the earliest period of Christianity. Hence, it crops up, you know, everywhere in all the kind of strands of the New Testament. And the significance of it is that this is God's own throne. I mean, a tremendously important theological symbol for Jews, the throne of God, from which God governs the whole cosmos. And there it is in the heights of heaven. The imagery of height was terribly important to them. The throne of God at the summit of the cosmos, as it were. Jesus is seated alongside the Father on that. Now, one of the things I'm doing in the book is trying to relate what Christians thought about Jesus to what Jews thought about the one God, and to ask the question, what was unique about the one God for Jews? If a pagan asked a Jew, and this must have happened endless times, you know, why do you only have one God? We all have lots of gods. Why can't you worship our gods as well as yours? What would Jews have said that makes the one God unique? And I think the most obvious things they would have said, and they crop up here everywhere in Jewish literature, they would have said God is the only creator of all things, and God is the only sovereign lord of all things. And they're very neat ways of specifying the uniqueness of God, because they both relate God to everything else. So by definition, nothing falls outside those two categories. God is the only creator. God is the only lord. Now, Jesus seated on the right hand of God on the throne is sharing God's cosmic rule over all things. He's not just a servant of God like the angels. He's not just carrying out God's will by governing the world. He's actually on the throne at God's side, participating in the divine sovereignty. And I think that's one of the ways in which early Christians were, as I put it, including Jesus in the divine identity, because to be the sole sovereign governor of all things was part of who God was. It wasn't something he could just sort of share with anybody. And so the early high Christology was evidently quite closely tied with the belief that Jesus was now seated on the throne of God in heaven. Why did they come to think that? It's a difficult question. I don't think I have a too easy an answer to it. I think that if we believe the Gospels, Psalm 110 verse 1 had been used by Jesus himself in his last days and at his trial before the high priest. So they may have been drawn to that text because Jesus himself had pointed to it. They may have had visions of Jesus seated, as Stephen does in Acts 7, you know, before his martyrdom. He sees Son of Man, in this case, standing at the right hand of God, because he's standing to deliver judgment on the Jewish priests. But I don't think we really know exactly how Christians came to the view that Jesus was seated at the right hand of God, but it was terribly important.
It was obviously something they did believe. Now, I mean, do you go as far as Richard does, James, in your understanding of how highly Jesus was revered by early Christians, particularly Jewish Christians, you know, and yet it wasn't at odds with their belief in the one God. I mean, the Shema was something Jews would have known, you know, in their sleep, probably recited it. You know, hear, O Israel, Yahweh our God, Yahweh is one. And yet, it strikes us now as being so obviously seemingly a contradiction, the idea that Jesus is also God, you know, the Trinity. I mean, do you think that that was a problem? I mean, you mentioned that certainly it seems to have been a problem in John when certain people have interactions with Jesus and call him a blasphemer, etc. So where do you think it,
I mean it's more yes and no whether I agree in a way. I mean I can see Richard's exegesis. I see it's a very strong case. I certainly think it explains, let's say, late first century, second century Christology of a proto-Orthodox type, if you like. My reservations are about how early this might be. John's Gospel, as you mentioned, certainly has disputes over Jesus making himself equal with God. The Jews, as John calls them, are really offended by this. So we've got something behind John's Gospel where it looks as if the deification of Jesus is a serious problem for a Jewish audience, whatever that might be. Now, the material in 1 Corinthians or the Philippians hymn or something like this is certainly placing Jesus extremely highly, that I've no doubt. It could be pushing it as highly as possible, certainly. But my reservations are based on the idea that there were various elevated figures in early Judaism, and particularly things like wisdom or the word of God were described in both terms, which is very difficult to, I think. Is it part of God? Is it something separate? Something like this. So there's still that issue there in early Judaism, which makes me wonder if someone like Paul hasn't quite pushed it as far as John yet, because there isn't the conflicts, it seems to me, prior to John's Gospel, let's say prior to the end of the first century. And that's where I have the reservations. I mean, it's clear it's very high, but how high?
Let's just, for the benefit of someone listening who may not be aware of the chronology of things, because often when you read the New Testament, you think Paul's letters came after the Gospel of John. In reality, it's the other way round. Mm. Paul was the first person he wrote before any of the Gospels were set
some
down.
Some of us would dispute that. Well,
but that's the generally accepted view, isn't it? That Paul, if you like, is our earliest writing about Jesus. And so texts like Philippians and Corinthians, where he says things about Jesus and is reflecting what the audience, the earliest Christians he wrote to, were saying, are our first evidence of what people thought about Jesus. And then something like the Gospel of John, which, where would you guys date that as having been written around
towards the end of the century?
That is therefore, in your view, James, had longer to crystallise thoughts about Jesus's divinity, and there was more of, to your mind, seems to be more of an issue at stake there at that
certainly
point.
I mean that's a crucial point, I think. I mean, it may be, of course, that Paul did push it far, but just didn't, it wasn't in any engagement with this, of course. And then it comes to, when, by the time these views get to John, it becomes a series, but it does lack,
I mean, Paul never seems to, does he, particularly engage the issue of these people are saying Jesus is not God, these Jews. It's more about proving why Jesus fulfills the messianic expectations of Jewish people. That's most often what I seem to be reading.
Yeah, and there is certainly lots of conflicts with Jewish opponents in Paul's letters, you see. So,
well, are there? I mean, it doesn't seem to me that very often in Paul's letters he engages directly with non-Christian Jews. He's usually debating with other Christian leaders, isn't he? And
certainly
people he regards as false teachers in the Christian movement.
I suppose I was thinking more of stories in Acts where he goes to the synagogue and he reasons
with them.
But
you see, what you get in Acts always is Paul's first sermon when he arrives in such and such a place, first sermon in the synagogue. Luke never tells us what he went on to talk about, so that Paul is primarily, if he's addressing a Jewish audience in Acts, he's interested in setting the scene against the story of Israel that they all know and showing how Jesus fulfills that story and so forth. He doesn't get on any further than that. So I think if Acts is reliable, it's reliable only in giving us an idea of how Paul started his evangelistic work. It doesn't tell you what he went on to. Can I just quote one of the really remarkable texts, I think? You referred a little while ago to the Shema, which is the sort of Jewish creed, really, and devout Jews said this every morning and evening. Your God, the Lord is one. And Paul in 1 Corinthians 8, 6, and this is a context of talking about what Christians may do in a pagan context where there are lots of gods around and food offered to them and so forth. He says, "Yet for us there is one God, the Father, from whom all things and for whom we exist, and one Lord, Jesus Christ, through whom are all things and through whom we exist." Now, one thing he's doing there is he's taking the words of the Shema and he's distributing them between God the Father and Jesus. So the Shema says one God and one Lord. Paul divides those titles between the Father and Jesus, and he also partitions the divine relationship to the world between the Father and Jesus. I think it's an extraordinary thing to say. He's actually, it seems to me, incorporating Jesus into the one God of the Shema, the way the Shema defines the one God. He's not just if he were adding Jesus on to that, he's saying, "Oh, there's one God, and by the way, there's also one Lord who you didn't know about." That would be blasphemous. I mean, that would be polytheism. That would be adding another God. What he's actually doing is incorporating Jesus into the Jewish definition of the one God. I think that's really quite remarkable. And it's a very good question. Why don't we see more conflict with other Jews about that? In 1 Corinthians, of course, he's really working very much in a non-Jewish context. Very few Jews, apparently, in the church at Corinth. He's really dealing with issues in the pagan environment. And I think I would have to say that really Paul's letters give us very little material which would enable us to see how Jews responded to Paul's theology, objections they had and so on. I mean, Paul does seem to be carrying on, to a very large extent, an inner Christian debate rather than a Christian versus Jewish debate.
And hence the context in which it was written was Christian believers worrying about whether they should be eating food offered to idols, etc.
Exactly.
And if you like, he was spelling out the way in which Jesus is part of, yes, the Godhead, in that sharing this divine identity.
Yes.
I mean, you're very keen in this book, Richard, to stress against what James was just saying, and perhaps you could come back on this, James, that they were specifically not talking about Jesus as a kind of elevated being in the way that other figures were talked about in that way around the same time. But you're concerned, James, that you're not sure that it really goes as far as Richard's saying, and there is a possibility Jesus was seen more in terms of a divine spiritual being, but that certainly didn't quite share the status of Yahweh.
Possibly, yes. I mean, again, I come back to the conflicts, which I'll mention in a minute. I mean, you could do, again, wisdom or the word of God is a very sort of ambiguous concept, whether it's a part of God or not, kind of thing. That's why I think, combined with the lack of conflicts in Paul's letters over Christology, makes me hold back on the issue. Certainly, you can read what Richard does into these kinds of texts, and certainly you could come up with John's gospel kind of thing. I don't think there's it's hard, very far removed. Certainly not. And as for the conflicts, I certainly buy Richard's points, but I just wonder, throughout, say, Acts and throughout Paul's letters, you do get conflicts occurring where it's from people from a Jewish background of some sort. So, get the incident of Antioch, for instance. Things like this do occur, and they just don't occur in the same way in terms of Christology. That's why I would just hold back for now. I mean, it's, the difference is, paper thin in some ways, I think, between me and Richard here. But I think that's what holds me back, really, from fully buying the kind of argument Richard suggests.
Can I come back on the word and wisdom of God? It's a very important point, I think. I mean, there are a whole lot of these so-called mediator figures that people have made a great deal of. But in my view, the word and the wisdom of God are in a different category from figures like Enoch exalted to heaven, or those sorts of figures, angelic figures. Because the word and the wisdom of God are God's own word, God's own wisdom. And it's hard to be sure in those passages in Jewish literature that sort of personify the word and the wisdom of God. It's hard to be sure whether that's a kind of literary device or how far. But what it does seem to me to mean is that the word and wisdom are intrinsic to God's own identity. I mean, God could not be God without his wisdom or without his word. You know, I mean, they belong to who God is. And that's what I'm saying about Jesus. And that's why I think those categories were useful to Paul. I think he draws, perhaps not as often as people have said, but I think he does draw on wisdom ideas here and there. And, of course, John, in his prologue, starts by using precisely the word image. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. So I think those categories of word and wisdom are not sort of semi-divine intermediaries, that they are, they actually belong to God's identity. In that sense, there was a kind of precedent in the Jewish understanding of God, depending on quite how one takes those. You know, I think the text may vary. I think sometimes there may be personifications. I think sometimes there may be rather more serious kind of distinctions within God. But I do think whatever they are, they belong to who God is.
We'll go into some more detail on that, and I'd like to sort of pursue the whole area of, well, if that is the case, you know, how much more of a leap was it to seeing what was a human figure, then, if you like, personified as part of the divine identity of God, etc., and how different that was. You're listening to a fascinating discussion as we go right back to the early Christians. We've had similar debates on this in the past, but I think we're really getting to the core of how Christians viewed, in their Jewish context, Jesus, how that could have been that they saw Jesus as part of the Godhead. Didn't that immediately cause a conflict? Not according to Richard Borkham, who in his book Jesus and the God of Israel says actually the Christian belief that Jesus is divine was not incompatible with the Jewish mindset and the way it viewed God. And we'll get a bit more from Richard on that. And James Crossley, if you like, casting some of the questions towards Richard in the course of the programme today as we examine this. So do join me again in a couple of minutes' time as we continue to look into this subject.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
We'll bring you a high-level discussion this afternoon as we look into the earliest Christian beliefs about Jesus. Were there belief that Jesus is divine incompatible with, if you like, the strong Jewish monotheism that they had to have come out of? That's long been the concern of many church and biblical historians, that these beliefs must have arisen at a later stage in a pagan context. It cannot have been so closely wedded to the Jewish community, which would have seen any idea of, in any sense, splitting the God or more than one God as totally abhorrent. And we've been talking to some extent, Richard, about the way that you see that there isn't this conflict that many people have assumed. In fact, you talk in your book about the problem of seeing Jesus in as God in ontic or functional terms. And you say you want to make clear that what people were concerned about, what Paul was concerned about, was seeing Jesus as part of the unique identity of God, as you term it. So give us a little bit more on that and what you mean by that. How's that distinguished from the later problems that were to emerge when people started talking about the Trinity?
Well, yes. I mean, New Testament scholars have tended to work this distinction between functional Christology and ontic Christology. And the meaning is, functional Christology means that you can talk about Jesus fulfilling divine functions. He does things God does. You know, he participates in creation along with God. He judges the world. He saves. Functional Christology, and separating that very sharply actually from ontic Christology, which tells you that in some sense Jesus is God. It's about Jesus being and not just his function. Now, I think against the background of Jewish theology at the time of Jesus and the early church, this distinction really doesn't make sense, because ruling all things from his cosmic throne, creating all things without any assistant. These are definitive of who God is. They're not mere functions. They are functions, but they're functions integral to who God is. So that to attribute those functions to Jesus says a lot more than just functions. These are uniquely divine functions. So I think the functional ontic split doesn't work. And I think we do have to think about, you know, as soon as early Christians are saying that Jesus participates with his Father in the cosmic rule over the whole world from God's throne, I think we have to say that they are doing something like, and they don't have words for this, so I'm having to create them, but something like including Jesus in the identity of God. I use that word identity. I think that's another point where my proposal kind of is an advance on other ways of thinking about it. You know, the fathers taught us to think in terms of divine nature. Nothing wrong with that. They were working within a philosophical context where you know, what it is to be God is defined in terms of what divinity is. I think that, however, the early Christians are following a Jewish practice of thinking much more about who God is rather than what God is. And I use identity for who God is. What God is, you know, kind of nature. What am I is human. Who am I is Richard Borkham. Very rough sort of thing, but I think it's quite useful in this context. So I think Jews were not totally unconcerned about divine nature, but the important thing for Jews was who God is. He's the God who created all things. He's the God who spoke to Israel at Sinai, made Israel his people. All these are kind of giving a personal identity to God. And so Jesus is being included, is my argument, within that personal identity of God. So the problem of divine nature being attributed to Jesus is a false problem. That's not what we should necessarily be looking for in the New Testament. It's this inclusion in the identity of God. And you see, I think that what happened very soon in early Christianity is that early Christians were saying in very Jewish terms the same sort of thing as the fathers got to saying in Greek philosophical terms only in the 4th century, you know. And what actually happened in the early church after the New Testament period is a certain degree of alienation from Jewish ways of thinking and having, as it were, therefore, to do the job all over again with a different conceptuality.
I mean, but isn't it fair enough that someone like James might sort of take issue with you? Because it's still a kind of paradigm shift, isn't it, to start attributing these understanding of who God is to a person who was walking around not that long ago.
It's still
would surely grate with a Jewish mindset to be talking about this Jesus character in this way.
Yes. I think that's right. I don't think Jews would necessarily be offended merely by the idea of, an aspect of God, like the word or the wisdom of God, being treated as a kind of, in some way, separable from God. I mean, the sort of distinctions within God, I don't think were a great problem. But when you start saying that a distinction within God is the human person of Jesus, who was crucified. Of course, one thing that Paul does tell us about Jewish reaction was, you know, the cross was a stumbling block to Jews. And I think it's really, for Jews what was really shocking was the inclusion of this man within the Godhead, rather than simply, you know, this idea of the unity of God being an issue in itself. I mean, that's a much later thing. You know, Jews and Muslims get to saying that God must be kind of unitary. There can't be distinctions within God. But I don't think that's a Jewish concern at this period. So I think you're right. It's the inclusion of a human being, and not only a human being, but this human being, a sort of failed Messiah who's been repudiated by the Jewish theocracy. I think that's more the sort of problem that they felt. And the other point, what emerges from this is, I think, the really remarkable novelty of what the early Christians did. You see, I think they did two things. In the first place, they included Jesus within the identity of God. But secondly, doing so then told you something about the identity of God. Who is God if Jesus belongs to his identity? And that, I think, leads them to a view of God as submitting to the shame of human life as we see it in Jesus. And the passage in Philippians, you know, which is one of the key passages of Pauline Christology, which everyone discusses, the story of the one who was in the form of God, not thinking divinity is something to hold on to, but he becomes human, he dies.
The nature of a servant.
He takes the nature of a servant. He dies, even death on the cross, and then he's awarded the divine name and so forth. That is really thinking in terms of honour and shame. They're the main categories there. It's this height imagery again. You know, the Son of God leaves the height of heaven where he's served by angels, the glory of heaven, the honour, to come down to the human level, to involve himself in human life, even to the point of dying condemned as a criminal. And it's as though that human career of Jesus is now telling you something about God. That's what God is like. It's not necessarily only the glory. It's being willing to surrender the glory for the humanity and the shame of being the man Jesus that tells us who God is.
For you, James, is this too much of a sharp break from what traditional Jewish worship would have been to sort of be plausible as having been so early as Richard is claiming? I mean, are you of the view that this high Christology, which Richard claims is in things like Philippians, do you take it as far as Richard is showing there, that this was about God, basically, not just about Jesus? I mean, do you think that's what it's pointing to in this passage?
I think there must be an element, at least the implications of the Philippians passage. Again, if you're thinking of it in terms of that wisdom word ambiguity you get with God, it might be showing us what wisdom a word could be like potentially. But of course, if you are going to equate Jesus with God, or whatever Paul is doing in this stronger sense, then yes, I mean, it is telling us something about God, obviously. I think that's a quite natural implication. The other thing about this being a sharp break from Judaism, I buy what Richard says. Of course, the idea of a crucified figure is a big problem. But again, I think the deification of a human being itself, I would go for the more general thing as well, is a serious, serious problem in Judaism. At least it seems to be unprecedented as far as we know. Again, John's Gospel would say how difficult this is, you know, for the Jews, as John calls them. It is the Jews who have the problem with this. And I don't think it's just simply the crucified person, although that's certainly a problem. I think the very issue of deifying a human being, I mean, I think that you do get the roots of the Islamic and Jewish objections to Christianity in something like John's Gospel of earliest Christianity.
You see it coming through there. Do you agree, Richard, that John shows more of a conflict? And why isn't that conflict in Paul's thinking? I mean, why does Paul seem to transition so very easily into seeing, you know, if we do believe Paul was this high-ranking Jew, you know, who would have been steeped in monotheism, how can you account for it becoming such an easy thing for him to...
Well, yes, I mean, I think you see that Jewish monotheism was... I say that it's structurally open to this development. You know, it was something you could do and remain a Jewish monotheist. That doesn't mean it wasn't surprising and strange and lots of people would resist doing it. But it does mean that Paul doesn't have to be surrendering anything in order to take this on. You know, there's scope, as it were, within the standard Jewish understanding of God, there's scope for this. But it's remarkable. I mean, he's very remarkable. And, I mean, like a lot of, you know, I mean, new ideas appear, new things happen, religions start, you know, things usually have a degree of continuity. Something like the origins of Christianity have a degree of continuity with also an element of surprise and newness. I think there certainly is more going on in John's Gospel than in terms of debate. I mean, I actually think the reason John starts his Gospel where he does, in the beginning was the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and so forth. And, of course, you read the prologue and you find out that the Word became flesh and is identified as Jesus. I mean, what Paul is doing actually is starting all over again at the beginning of Genesis, in the beginning, where Genesis starts, and he's taking a feature of the Genesis story, which is that God creates by speaking, and he's saying that's where Jesus was. In his pre-existence, in God, in eternity. So he's actually identifying Jesus with something. And that's a way a way of saying that Jesus, you know, worship of Jesus is compatible with monotheism, because Jesus is the Word of God that was there in the beginning. So I think early Christians are concerned. And you see, I think that reformulation of the Shema in 1 Corinthians 8 may well be a response to Jewish objections that you're worshipping a second God. Paul is saying, no, not a second God. This Jesus belongs within the unity of the one God. So it's a question. It's partly a question of how we understand what Paul is saying. And Paul is not going to respond to Jewish criticism by saying, well, after all, Jesus is only a man. He's going to respond to it by redefining monotheism and say, you know, we hold on to monotheism. And I think that reformulation of the Shema, though it's in that very pagan context in 1 Corinthians 8, I mean, it looks very much like something Paul had already formulated. You know, it was being used. He's not inventing it for the first time when he writes that chapter. So, I mean, that reformulation of the Shema itself may have come out of a desire to be quite explicit about Christians remaining Jewish monotheists, but incorporating Jesus into that definition.
We'll just take a quick break there to give you a chance to write down, if you would like to get in touch, our email address, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Would you like to comment on anything you've heard on the programme today? Perhaps you've got a view on the Christology of Jesus, whether the earliest believers really believed Jesus was God. Would welcome your responses to today's show. Do get in touch. unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Don't forget, if you visit the Unbelievable webpage, you can download this programme. You can also see a vast archive of past programmes there. You can get hold of the podcast. I'm sure there's many things you'll want to see if you're interested in this kind of discussion. That's premier.org.uk/unbelievable, and you can visit the Unbelievable group on the Premier community while you're there. Okay, let's get back into the discussion here in the studio.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
James, anything to add to that? I mean, I'm wondering sort of where do you stand specifically on how early this, you know, what you might call the orthodox view of Jesus as it came to be was. Do you think that Paul and his community were worshipping Jesus in the same terms that Richard might today? I mean, were they thinking about Jesus in a different way to what we think of now in the Christian world as the Jesus, the Son of God?
I mean, it's a very difficult question in many ways, because, I mean, you listen to Richard and read his book, he needs the kind of elaborate theological language to discuss this, which we don't actually have behind Paul all the time. We need to go back and look at all this, use all this detailed language to explain the possibilities. So it's very, very difficult to make that comparison. Of course, there's the obvious continuity between contemporary Christians and doing something remarkable with Jesus. All this material wouldn't have been set in stone, fixed, sorted out there and then. You know, Christianity had to go through centuries before there was anything like, you know, a defined issue. I mean, even John's Gospel, people still have to try to bring together seemingly contradictory elements about Christology. Whether they are contradictory, I don't know. I mean, but it's a bit more, things are in flux still, I think.
What about the other Gospels? Do you think that they bring across as stronger senses these passages from Paul or John's Gospel do of the deity of Christ?
Not really. There is the Matthew and Q passage that talks about the Son only revealing, and that's Jesus. They don't have the kind of strong disputes with the Jews in generalised terms over the making yourself equal with God. And again, I think if those kind of passages were known to the Gospel writers, presumably they would have incorporated them into the Gospels. And thus, I don't... whether what they believed separately from the Gospels, of course, might be a completely different thing. They may have well have thought, had elevated views of Jesus, but they're certainly not in any sustained way like John's Gospel written down. So I think there is a significant difference there.
And so, from that point of view, would you be suspicious of the idea that those Christians who wrote the Gospels, Matthew, Mark and Luke, did have the same view as the writer of John about the deity of Jesus? Do you think that they weren't making the same claims in their gospel?
Certainly not the same claims in the text, put it that way. I mean, it's very difficult to speculate what was going on behind the scenes and things. And remember, these tend to be reports of what's going on in Galilee and so on, where Jesus didn't seem to be making such grand claims for himself as you get in Philippians or something like that. So they wouldn't necessarily have been reporting these things. But John still, of course, did write up these disputes in terms of high Christological debates, but not present in the Gospels.
Can I come back to Mark?
Yeah.
You know, because, well, chapter 2 of Mark, you get the scribes reacting to Jesus' healing and forgiving sins by saying, who can forgive sins but God alone? Mm. You know, they're expressing precisely one of these uniquely divine functions. When Jesus stills the storm, the story ends up with another of these... I mean, Mark loves these questions, you know, draw your own conclusions, he's saying, but they're leading questions. The end of stilling of the storm, who is this that even the winds and the sea obey him? Again, very Old Testament thing. Only God can compare. Only God can rule the chaos
and bring
that's
order
expressed.
Out of chaos,
bring
yes.
order out of chaos. Exactly.
Very Old Testament idea.
Why do you call me good? No one is good but God alone, Jesus says to the scribe. And it's wonderful double entendre. You know, within you know, if you're not thinking, you can say that Jesus is saying, "No, I'm not God." But you think further. Of course Jesus is good. All Christians believe that Jesus is good. So it actually works the other way. Who is good but God alone? Jesus is God. And then the declaration before the high priest, the sort of climax of all this, is what Jesus says: you will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven, seated at the right hand of God, coming on the clouds of heaven. You've got that seated at the right hand of God thing again. So I think... Mark, again, the difference between John and Mark is that John spells all this out at great length and does more systematic theological thinking about it. But it's all there in Mark already.
Okay. On the Mark and passages, I mean, certainly they are making claims about Jesus. I just don't think it's quite as high, if you like, as John. On the stilling of the storm and so on, Moses can be described in these terms as the elements obeying him. God gives authority to Moses, Philo's Life of Moses. Mark 2, is a question perhaps about authority from God. You get this turning up in the next chapter in Mark 3. English translations forgive, but it could be, it's very wide semantic, it could be loosen, things like this. It could all be about healing and exorcisms, where Jesus gets his authority. He thinks it's from God, his opponents think it's from the satanic. And so I think this could be the big debate about authority. Now, I think I got a suspicion that the origins of a lot of Christological debate may well come from things like this, the exorcisms and healings, where Jesus gets his authority and so on, and by the finger of God, I cast out Beelzebub, and things like this. But I don't think this is quite there like John's gospel. This is still in the realm where we could compare Jesus with someone like Moses, or retellings of the stories of Moses, or someone like that. I mean, John does something different, I think.
I mean, but I still read Mark myself as sort of a story about the disciples cottoning on that Jesus is more than just a man. You say, Richard, that in that Jewish culture it wouldn't have been so hard as maybe we think now for someone to be identified in the unique identity of God. Maybe we suffer a bit from being so immersed in, as you've said, sort of Greek philosophy since, that we kind of... think there must have been all these issues, and in reality there weren't at the time that people were suggesting that Jesus was this person.
I mean, I do think some of the difficulty people imagine Jews must have had is to do with this idea of the unitariness of God. I mean, what Jews were concerned about is that God is the only God, but what later developed in all three traditions, three monotheistic traditions, is the idea that God's nature is unitary and cannot have distinctions within it. And of course this causes tremendous problems in Christian theology, where they want to say that and yet also say that God is Trinity. But I don't think that was a concern in early Judaism. What they're concerned is that God is the only God, not with this kind of internal lack of distinction within God. And that's the sense in which I think Jewish monotheism at that stage was open to the kind of development that the early Christians gave it. And, you know, there's a fine balance between saying it was open and also saying it was very surprising and not at all surprising that lots of Jews didn't go along with this, you know. But I do think we have to get that thing about the unitariness of God straight, that this was not the way God, not the way Jews were thinking at the time. And so what is really important for the early Christians to have a high view of Jesus and to preserve monotheism is to include Jesus in the identity of God. And I think the other thing where we may be sort of differing a bit, actually, is Jewish, in my view, Jewish monotheism drew this hard line of distinction between God and all of created reality. I mean, you really cannot have semi-divine figures, because God is the only creator and only Lord. So you're on one side of the distinction, you know. So the idea that by a sort of slow kind of exalting of Jesus until he gets to the top of the sort of creaturely ladder and then doesn't really help. I mean, the gulf between God and being a creature is just as big once you've got to that exalted place. You know, the gulf between God and being the most important angel is
still a huge gulf.
Vast. Yeah. I mean, it's a sort of metaphysical gulf. This idea that you could kind of... And this is where I think the difference with pagan monotheism becomes important, that James mentioned, I think, earlier. Really, pagans and Jews are operating with two different models of monotheism. When pagans get to something like monotheism, what they're really saying is that there is a single high God, and there are lots of lower divinities that, you know, you can honour in the temples and so on, you know. And so the view of worship for the pagan is that you worship gods to the degree that's appropriate on this kind of hierarchy. Just as in a human political situation, you would bestow some honour on a low magistrate and more honour and huge honour on the emperor, you know, sort of scale. Jews had developed worship as the distinction between God and all other reality. What you're actually saying in worship is saying you are the only God. You're the only one who deserves worship. Of course, that goes right back to the Ten Commandments. It's very fundamental in sort of the central Jewish texts, the Shema and the Ten Commandments for Jews in this period. So for Jews, worship marks the boundary between God and all other reality. And you can see that actually in Jewish responses to paganism, Jewish discussion with pagans in the diaspora, that this is very, this is why pagans think Jews are atheists, you know, because they won't worship any of their gods. And they're not saying, you know, you have to make Zeus tremendously important. They're saying, well, you just worship our gods along with yours. Yeah. Why not? Yeah. Why do you have to be so strict about this? But Jews were strict about that. Mm. Very definition, you know, it's a sort of self-defining thing that...
So the very fact that Jesus was worshipped by Jews is in itself, if you like, proof of his divinity as in their eyes.
Yes, that's what I'm arguing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, do you buy that, James, that alone, if you like, signifies they saw him in the highest terms you could see?
Yes, I mean, I think you need it in conjunction with the kind of exegesis Richard's done. You know, in terms of the language of worship could be used for lesser things and people and so on. By the way, the earliest Christians use it, it's difficult, but I think it has to move in that direction, certainly. I mean, I prefer a more kind of messy view, if you like, of all this. I agree with the general outline Richard does, but it just seems a bit too strict.
A bit too cut and dried, yeah, so it kind of just popped into being... quickly.
Yeah, I mean, there's a little bit of that. I mean, because pagans could see the similarity between the monotheistic system of Christianity and Judaism and theirs, whereas, you know, you call them angels, we call them gods. What's the difference? Now, of course, there's difference when you get to the details, but you could, you know, people were seeing the similarities between the two approaches. So on the issue of... Yes, I do see there is this idea of the overarching God and even the highest angel. But even then, I mean, we mentioned things about the divine name perhaps being given to an angel. I mean, we've talked about, I think, the apocalypse of Abraham, where you certainly mentioned it in your book. You know, these are... I know you dismiss them as precedents, and I see your point. But there is something there, maybe, to help make the link between getting Jesus up there, if you see what I mean.
Is it your view then, James, that by the time Christians were professing Jesus as God, essentially, that was the result of an increasing elevation of the status of Jesus? I mean, do you believe it happened that way? Because you're fundamentally saying that's not the case, Richard. You're saying even if that had been the case, they would still not have got to the point that Paul seems to get to very early on, you know.
It's an interesting question, an important question, is how do you get to that stage? I mean, ultimately we know that Christianity, one of the main areas of self-definition was the idea of Jesus was God, which makes it distinct from the pagan world, makes it distinct from the Jewish world, which makes it a religion in its own right. Now, as in the building up of elevating Jesus further and further, whether they were consciously doing this, I don't know. There were certainly speculations on who Jesus was. We know this from Paul, we know it from the Gospels, and so on. And then maybe it just took that one step for John's Gospel to spell it out, perhaps. Why Christians did it is a very difficult issue. Again, I think the identity thing is important to define yourself in the ancient world, both from this developing sect from within Judaism and so on. And John's Gospel, again, I suspect there must be something behind John's Gospel which really crystallises and clarifies all these issues. You've got a dispute with a local Jewish community or whatever it is defined as the Jews, and it's over this issue of the deification of Jesus, and maybe it took something like a conflict to spell these issues out and get. Maybe it is just an obvious implication of what's been said before. Perhaps these weren't speculated in much detail. We don't know enough, I think. But John's Gospel certainly reflects one of the key moments, I think, in the history of Christology.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll just have some final thoughts from our guests as finish up thinking about the worship of Jesus as God. How early was it? Did the first Christians really see Jesus in those divine terms? How much of a conflict was there with Orthodox Judaism? There certainly is now. Was there back then? We'll just continue finishing up our thoughts in just a moment's time here on Unbelievable.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Well, as we finish our conversation, gentlemen, I mean, something I wanted to ask you just before we get to those final thoughts, Richard. James said, you know, was trying to put forward reasons why Christians would have started to define themselves with a certain point, you know, belief. Jesus is God, you know, wanted to see themselves as defined from the pagan world, but also from Judaism. I mean, what about the Christian who says, I just believe they had a new revelation, you know, which came by things like Paul and his vision on the road to Damascus, things, you know, people saw the resurrected Jesus. This was the reason why they started worshipping Jesus as God, because it was apparent that that was the case. I mean, obviously, not being able to, as it were, say these things happened, James, necessarily. Another person might say, well, I'm quite happy with the idea that they happened, and they're a good enough reason for people starting to worship Jesus as God in this way. I mean, would that kind of be a reasonable explanation in your eyes, Richard?
I do think, I mean, obviously the issue of self-identification is terribly important for a minority religious group. But it's another issue as to why it should be that particular issue that becomes the self-defining thing. And you see, if you imagine the first Christians in Jerusalem, what they were doing apparently was regularly worshipping in the temple with all other Jews. They had no problem about doing that. They went daily to the temple services. But they were also meeting in homes for the kind of distinctively Christian bit of their worship. And so they were a group within Judaism, no question about it. Now, to meet separately, there, of course, have to be defining features of them that are different from the general run of Jews. It doesn't seem to me that worshipping Jesus in any way had to be the obvious thing you would do if that was your concern. So I think there is a kind of sociological issue here of a minority group defining itself, but I don't think that in itself can, as it were, solve the theological issue of why it should be this particular belief and practice. I think it's very important that it is a religious practice, you know, not just a belief. It's not just a little creedal thing that you say. And, I mean, lots of Christians say things in the creeds that don't really have much impact on what they do. But the worship of Jesus it seems to me, was a very core religious practice for the early Christians. So it was kind of it was something that was happening all the time, a belief that was being put into practice. So I think the early Christians are responding to something, you know. What had happened in Jesus' life, ministry, death, resurrection, exaltation. I mean, somehow this all added up to, this is an absolutely remarkable man. This is as remarkable as you get. This man must belong to the identity of God. Mm.
And you believe that it wasn't just that, you know, you can see that in Acts and the letters, that things like the rituals such as communion had become part of that worship tradition, where obviously Jesus was being worshipped in some sense. But you believe it was actual worship fit that would only have been attributed to God by those people in any other circumstance, and therefore worship of God in that circumstance.
Precisely, because I think worship was such a, for Jews, worship was the fundamental way of distinguishing between God and all other reality. You know, it's what you were doing when you were worshipping. You were distinguishing God from his creation. You were saying, you are the only God. You are the one who's worthy of worship, and no one else is. So it, within a Jewish context, worship is a tremendously kind of meaningful and sensitive issue. You wouldn't worship Jesus without some notion of what you were doing, without some notion of the significance of this within a Jewish theological context.
James, some final thoughts from you as we approach the end of this particular debate.
Well, yes, I mean, I agree with much of that, especially the idea of we should be looking at various different other issues feeding into the idea of self-identity. I think, as I mentioned, issues of Jesus' exorcisms probably had an important role. Paul's vision, no doubt, was crucial as well. All these things are feeding in to it. I mean, you know, we could never have the, you know, a nice, wonderful, neat explanation for it. It is a bit chaotic, historical reasons at any given time. Certainly not inevitable. Nothing ever is. But I guess once you start centering everything on Jesus, you can see how this, with the benefit of hindsight, was to become the most important, or perhaps joint important feature of defining Christianity over against the broader Jewish world and the broader pagan world.
Well, it's been a fascinating discussion. If you want to find out more, do read Richard's book, Jesus and the God of Israel. I'll again put a link up with this programme so that you can get hold of the book. The core of it is, Richard, the essay you wrote, God Crucified. Now, when did that originally come out?
Quite a long time ago, I forget.
Must have been in the late 90s, was it, that you wrote that?
1998.
Yes. And so in a sense, this is expanding on it in the subsequent chapters where have come back with questions and things, and you've sought to sort of further that thesis. I mean,
yes. God Crucified is very much a sketch of an argument, right, which I'm kind of filling out now.
Absolutely.
Yes.
I mean, do you feel in the way that Jesus and the Eyewitnesses has sort of really had quite an impact on the area of form criticism and the way that we should approach the Gospels and their historicity, that this is kind of having an impact on the way people view early Christian belief and that sort of thing?
I think so, but it's nothing like as obvious as Jesus and the Eyewitnesses. I mean, I've had nothing like the range of written responses to this book as I have to others.
What's the significance of this one, then? I suppose you can see quite easily with Jesus and the Eyewitnesses what the significance of it is. It's saying something quite significant about those stories. What's the significance for you? When I read it, the significance for me was that, well, this is quite against a trend that sees Christianity as basically having been something that emerged rather than was there from the start.
Yes, it's a kind of Big Bang theory,
exactly,
of early Christianity. Yes,
and that, in a sense, is against, again, the sort of prevailing trend, would you say, of scholarship that has seen it more in terms of an evolution?
Yes, and I think it's kind of countercultural in that I think a lot of people in a secular world are much happier with the idea that Jesus was perceived as simply a human prophet, and then eventually, and of course in the sort of Da Vinci nonsense, you get the idea that all the Emperor Constantine who does this, you know, and turns Christianity into a political religion by making Jesus God. I mean, no scholar believes that, you know, but that it shows you what some people would like to believe, you know, and I just think one's got to face up to the evidence that these very distinctive things about patristic Christianity were already very distinctive about the first Christian group.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen, for joining me again for the programme today. If you want to find out more, as I say, do visit the links at the Unbelievable page, and I'll point you in various directions there to find out more, as well as to previous programmes. We covered this sort of area with James before in his discussions with Michael Bird, so I'll put up some links to that programme as well there.
Thank you for listening to today's classic replay on the divinity of Jesus, which was first broadcast on Premier Christian Radio on the 10th of October 2009. You can get in touch and listen to more classic shows from our podcast archive at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.